Hey, it's Millie, and welcome to the Generalist World podcast. This is a show where I interview people from the Generalist World community, and we talk things like the future of work, careers, predictions, their hot takes, and really understand what their squealy careers have looked like. So if you're a generalist who feels like they're living in a specialized world, this is the podcast for you.
Hi, Natalie. Welcome to the GW podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Okay. I was looking at your background, all the cool stuff you've done, and I was like, where shall we start? I think where it would make most sense to start is to give people a flavor, if they haven't come across you before, of what we might touch in this episode and why should someone tune in? You know, maybe they're walking the dog or maybe they're cooking dinner. Why should they tune in for the next half an hour to hear from you?
Oh my God, there are so many topics we could talk about. Probably for GW that makes the most sense is my absolutely squiggly career and the amount of times I've transitioned and different transferable skill sets that really work as a generalist.
Ooh, yes, yes, yes. Let's start with the transferable skill sets because I think we're going through this feeling at the moment, a collective feeling of like, oh my gosh, everything's changing. Oh my gosh, I'm falling behind. What have you learned about having transferable skill sets?
It's really interesting you say that because obviously it is something that is very scary to everyone of like, if I've never done this before, why would somebody bring me on to do this exact thing? Like we'll use AI as a great example. Your skill set, what makes you uniquely you, doesn't go away just because you're sitting in front of a new audience or a new industry or a new type of work. And I think we've almost been like programmed to believe that we have to be so specialized and we have to be so trained in order to be successful. But and I'm going to get off topic a little bit, but we're human beings. And the thing that we love is that we keep growing and developing. So it's really odd that we think we're going to be doing the exact same type of work that we did when we were 18 than when we're doing when we're 60. So I think it's just, again, looking at who you are, what makes you you, and what you want to do next really allows for that transferable skills because you know what you can bring, and it could be a difference of opinion, it could be a new way of looking at things, it could be a skill set, but whatever you bring is unique and they can't replicate it. And so that's transferable.
And how do you think about communicating that? Because it's one thing for like us to be like, heck yeah, transferable. But when someone is, say, in a negotiation or maybe they're meeting with a new client, is there anything that you have learned where it might help someone who's not feeling so confident about communicating that?
I think the confidence piece is definitely something that's learned, right? So it's not something that people just automatically come out of the woodwork and be like, oh, I'm so confident. Like it is a skill set that we have to learn. That being said, I think it's really learning to take ownership of who you are and what you do well, what your secret sauce is. That gives you that confidence to have that conversation. If you don't believe in you, then the person on the other side of the table won't believe in you either. And it's a hard thing. And I'm going to be honest, especially for women, we have been trained that humble is the way to go, that we can't accept a compliment, that there's an ego part to it that is frowned upon. And that's not really the case. And it's a hard lesson to break. And so, again, having that conversation with somebody else is being able to say, this is what I do well. I know I can do this. Here's what I've done previously that shows my pattern of success. I can do that for you. And at the end of the day, if they say no, they're not saying no to you. They're just saying no to their vision of what goes in that spot. And that's okay. So rejection and learning that it's okay to put yourself out there, that not everything's going to be a yes, but that's okay.
And when you look back at your own squiggly career, if you look back and you kind of see the shape of it, Does it feel like something that you have designed or something that's kind of happened to you?
Happened to me, 100%. I could not design my life if I had tried. I think at this point in my life, I am intentionally designing, but I don't think I would have gotten to this point without the life happening to me. Mm-hmm. And so just very quick story, you know, I went to college. I was sure I was going to be a lawyer. And my roommate at the time, I think this is just such a fun story. My roommate at the time did a stupid college thing. She keyed somebody's car, right? And I went with her to court over it. Like, I went and I supported her. And I watched the legal system and realized, nope, that's not for me. And I decided to leave college at that time to take a step back and figure out what I really wanted to do, and fell into retail. I truly don't think I would be where I am now if I hadn't worked retail for so many years, especially multi-unit retail. It taught me so much and allowed me really to have that transferable skill set we talked about earlier to, you know, be able to accomplish so many other things I never dreamed about.
Fantastic story. And thank you to your friend, you know, shout out. That could have put you on a completely different life trajectory. And there's so something to like this try before you buy, you know, where we live in a world where access to knowledge and information is just so abundant. You can go and either, you know, spend a day in court in your example, or go and speak to a startup founder and be like, yo, what is this? What is this really like? Or perhaps be an operator. You know, I know you're huge on the fractional operator side. And it's like, this is amazing ways to get your foot in the door, to experience it, to ask yourself, what is it like? And often it's not, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. So there's so something about just keeping your like your blinds open to be like, what is that really like? And is that a fit for me? Just because it's a fit for someone else, it might not be a fit for me.
It's really interesting that you brought this up, because something that I have learned for myself as well is we are also kind of trained that there is this like sunken cost to what happens. So we have to continue doing it because we've already put in time or energy or whatnot. This idea that it no longer fits or serves me is very hard for us to get over. And like, I look at the educational system, right? You know, I remember growing up and, you know, my sister, my older sister, she went for one degree. She did it for a year and was like, nope, not for me. And I thought she was crazy. I'm like, the school loans you have, like you did. But she was right. You know, there is, she realized it didn't work. It didn't fit. It, to your point, try before you buy. She tried it and she's like, I'm not spending the rest of my year doing this. I do not like it. And I think that that takes a strength that a lot of us aren't developed in, to be able to say, hey, you know, I took this job, it's only been 3 months and I really don't like it. And that's okay for me to leave. Whereas I think everyone else is like, oh my God, I have to put in a couple of years. I can't do this. It looks like job hop. There's all these buts, but it just delays us. It's not for us. It's to fit somebody else's narrative that we think they have, not what actually works for us.
Yeah. And I always, it's a little morbid and maybe deep, but you know, fast forward to the end of your life and you're in those final days, are you going to regret that you spent years, not months, in something that didn't light you up, in something that didn't serve you? And even though in the moment, you're right, it takes huge courage to be able to say, actually, it's not for me. But I found that that like one door closing, another one opens. I don't know what the science is behind that, but it is true. And often I will have to really slam a door for all of these other opportunities to become abundant.
It's interesting that you said that, because I belong to another community and, you know, we talk a lot about, again, designing our career, designing where we want to go next. What do we want our life to look like? You know, being authentic to ourselves. And this came up actually when we were talking in the last meeting, because, you know, they called it almost like a trial. It's like almost like you think you know where you want to go. You think you're going there, but a trial comes up to just really test you do you really want that? Are you really in it? And it's an interesting way to look at it, to your point about closing all these doors of, if you leave too many like options open, you're really not committed. And so like everything falls away. Mm-hmm. And so as you go for that thing you want, it does almost seem like, oh, everything falls apart. And it's kind of like the universe saying, like, are you sure you really want this? Because once you commit, that's when everything hits and all those opportunities come in.
I feel that in my soul. I wonder, when you look back at your squiggly career, has there been any really standout moments where you realized that that door needed to close so that you could open a different one?
I would say really recently with fractional work, I was given an offer for a full-time role. And, you know, logistically, I'm an ops person, so very logically, my head was like, well, you know, it's, again, all these things that aren't accurate. Oh, it's stable. I'm going to get benefits. I'm going to get all of this stuff. And honestly, I felt so, I don't even know how to explain it, but like, it felt so uncomfortable to even consider the offer. I just knew that it was wrong. And I shut the door to that offer. And then ever since then, even with clients, like I have one fractional client right now, and one of the very first things she said to me is, would you come on full time? And I immediately always tell them no. No. Mm. I am here as a fractional person, part time. And, you know, when you need a full time, I'm more than happy to find somebody for you. But I have to keep that door shut because it doesn't serve me. And it allows me to lose focus on what I'm really trying to build and serve right now.
Okay, so I love that you have such a strong opinion and boundary on the kind of work, the model of work that you are pursuing. Why fractional? What leads to such a strong perspective that this is for you?
I think a couple of pieces there. So the first is, and again, we'll call this that squiggly line, I get bored after a while. Like, I like that new challenge. And so even when I was working for startups, I found usually about 18 months, I didn't feel as connected to it anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, it wasn't the company. Like, they didn't do any, it just, I had done what I wanted to accomplish when I got in there, and it just wasn't invigorating anymore, right? So fractional allows me that mentality of, I'm always going to be juggling multiple companies. I'm always going to be looking for new opportunities. It's what I want. It's more exciting and invigorating for me. Another piece to that puzzle, though, is I, like a majority of the world, have gotten caught up in layoffs. And I attached my personality, I attached my value of a human being to that role in that company. And when I was let go, it was really like I grieved for it, even though it was, like, I knew I wasn't going to be there forever, but I was so ingrained in that's who I was. And I know for myself, that is not who I am. I am valuable outside of work. I am valuable as a human being and a person. It is not what I provide for other people. It's just me. But I know that in order for me to remain who I am and being that authentic person, I can't put myself back in those positions of, I equate me with that company.
Isn't it funny how there's been this shift from, like, you know, corporate full-time 9-to-5 was seen as this like safe, secure kind of option. And now I feel like there's just this really huge shift away to where people are advocating for themselves. And they're like, actually, I'm going to bet on myself here. And I think what you're doing brilliantly is not losing sight of the worth that you have and like kind of detaching it from the work that you do.
It is true. And I do think it's something that we are, again, like, I'll go back to the educational system. I think this is something that we are all taught. You know, at some point you graduate high school or college, or, you know, you get a, whatever it is, you go into work and that is who you are. And I think it goes back to this old idea where their employer and employee relationship was very different. You know, you would work for a company maybe to your entire career, but you were able to have a work-life balance. You were able to pay for everything you wanted to pay for. You could buy a house. You could have a family. You were taken care of in retirement, and medical bills were really taken care of. And, you know, obviously, globally, everything is so different. But in the United States, that relationship has really changed. And I believe a big part of that is that corporations are no longer, hey, you build a car for 40 years and that's what your company survives on. Mm. They're constantly reinventing themselves. They're constantly changing. So their needs constantly change, which makes sense. But I think for employees, we still think of that relationship existing, even though it's changed. And that's what we really need to do, is we need to take a look at our ownership of what we want and what we want to build and where we want to go. And in some cases, that is a full-time job, but a side hustle. Like, mm-hmm. there is some kind of value that we do for ourselves that is outside of that 9-to-5. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it's like people like myself or you, we've left the entire corporate. You know, that doesn't serve us anymore. And that's okay. I think everyone needs to find their own way. But I think it starts with understanding that that relationship, employer-employee, is vastly different than it was 50 years ago.
Yeah, not spoken about enough as well. I think it's now starting to really seep into the zeitgeist and people are really starting to feel it. I want to touch a little bit further on your fractional business, because mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of listeners who are considering, who are perhaps where you were a couple of years ago, and they're considering making this jump. When I was researching for this, I found a post that I believe you were like sold out for your first year, maybe even a bit beyond a year. And I would love you to take me back to that time when you were nice and really early and fresh. And firstly, how did you become sold out for a year? Like, that's probably a dream for many. And secondly, what are some of the like big standout things that you would do differently?
Oh, 100%. Okay. So with fractional work, it usually is your first couple clients or people you know. Mine was unique. I had answered an ad on LinkedIn, not even like one of those job postings. It was on somebody's post that I ended up coming into my feed. And I applied, you know, and said, oh, yeah, this is something I'd love to do. It was, again, a fractional position. And it quickly grew, right? So I was able, between that and my other potential clients, that people I knew, to be sold out. So now let's go into the, well, that sounds great, right? It does. But when you are fractional for the first year, you kind of fall into things. Usually there is some kind of life transition that happens, and all of the things come to you, and you don't plan, you don't create a business. And so you don't think like an owner or a CEO or a president of your company. And you do things like I did, which was undervalued myself and charged a lot less because I assumed they could not afford it. I did over scope creep, you know, where I agree to do this type of service and then the rules quickly change and it is nothing of how I imagined. I took clients because I needed the money, instead of it being aligned with the work I wanted to do. And then the big one is I was sold out, so I stopped all of my business development. Mm. And then I fired my one client who was my biggest anchor, and I was like, oh crap, I don't have anyone in my pipeline. What do I do now? And so that's the other piece, is the constant relationship building, the constant marketing and networking. And again, it's not like I'm intentionally trying to sell, but you always have to know, like, let people know who you are, what you do, how you can help them, and obviously give back to them so that when they do need you, you are top of mind for them to reach out to you.
Mm. And I imagine there's a lot of ineffective ways to do this. I think there's so much like broad advice, which is just like network, post on LinkedIn, it's like, yeah, but what is the actual things that are working? Are there like one or two levers that you have noticed that have been the most effective to actually landing clients?
The first I will say is even the levers that I'm going to tell you guys to use work because I'm comfortable with them. If you are not comfortable with them, they do not work. So you have to be authentic, right? You have to do things that feel good for you. If you go and do something that doesn't fit you, people will smell it a mile away and it will be a huge turnoff for them, right? So that 100%. The things that I have seen that have worked for me and other fractionals consistently, no matter who they are two really big levers. The first is a referral network. And a referral network is trusted people who know you, who trust you, understand what you do, understand who your ideal client is, and they refer you when they need it, okay? So I'll give you a great example. I have a client, she started last week. We were talking and she says to me, I'm having an opportunity with marketing. This is what I need. I went into and it took me a couple of days, but I was like, who is the perfect person? Mm. I clicked. I was literally taking a shower and I'm like, oh my God, it's Pam. And so I reached out to Pam and I said, Pam, do you have availability? Like, would you be open to meeting? And that's the thing. Now, that is a referral network. It is because we are matching each other on things that make sense. The second biggest like lever to do is communities. How you build your community is completely different. It could be in-person networking events. It could be virtual. I personally have found Slack groups are great. One of the other communities besides Generalist World that I belong to is called the Old Girls Club. It is a great club and I love it. And people are constantly saying, hey, I need help with X. And so again, it's a great idea, but they only work when you show up and you support others. It's not a take. It has to be a true, authentic, I like to call it a garden. You plant a bunch of seeds, you water them, you make sure that they get lots of sun, maybe play some music. And at some point, some of them are going to bloom. You don't know who, you don't know where, but you know that it's going to happen. But if you don't give it water, none of them are going to bloom and you're just dead. So that is so important. And so same, those are the two levers that seem to work the best for fractionals.
Mm. Fantastic answer. And I totally feel that as well. You kind of develop, like, even in like larger communities, you start to develop these smaller circles and you get to really know those people. And because what you're really saying is like, you're putting your reputation on the line to recommend someone. So there has to be an element of like, okay, I really believe in this person and I trust that they're going to be able to follow through.
And it's 100% trust. But the reason the trust works so much better than, let's say, posting on LinkedIn or Instagram or marketing is because when somebody is looking for a vendor, a fractional, anything to solve a pain point, they trust people that they trust. So if person A has had the same problem or has worked with somebody who had the same problem and they found that this was effective, well, that person who's searching is going to be like, who did you use? And person A is like, oh, I used Natalie. Oh my God, I need to meet them. That is how it's a warm lead, but it's a trusted lead. Then that takes away the ick of the sales because it isn't a sale. It's, hey, I have the problem. This is a pain point. Are you the right person to help me? And that's where you as a fractional have to be, yes, I am, or no, I'm not. And it's okay to say, no, you're not. You have to be okay. Because the last thing you want to do is hurt that reputation of the person A who recommended you. And again, the only way you get more clients is to deliver what you say you're delivering.
And very tactically, like, what's your sweet spot for how many clients do you like to work with at any one time?
So my sweet spot for fractional clients is usually between 2 and 3. Again, it depends what work I'm doing. So in some cases, it could just be 2 if they're big. Right now, I have 1 big, 1 small, and so I can fit in another big one and still be okay. In addition, I also coach people who are setting up their own fractional business or need to evolve their fractional business. So it depends how many of those clients I have, because I never want to do coaching at the expense of my fractional clients and vice versa. So it is almost like a capacity game that I play every month and have to evaluate it to make sure I'm right. In addition, I just want to state, because this is again a big thing, in my capacity, I always leave networking, because you keep having to build those relationships, even if it's with current people you have. So that is part of me with my capacity.
That's a really important point. Do you ever feel like you're overwhelmed? I'm just thinking of like all the context switching that you must have to do. Is there any sense of like overwhelm or like bogged down or like, oh my gosh, wait, which client is which? Or how do you think about managing all that context switching?
So everyone does it differently, let's just be honest, right? And for me, I do it in kind of buckets. So if I have really big projects, like something that is heads down, extremely important, I will usually just block out that one day for that client to knock everything out. In other cases, when it's just like average context switching of like, I've got to do this for the customer, it happens every week, that I'll do, like, I'll block my time throughout the day of like 2 hours for this person and 2 hours for that person. That being said, of, you know, the great thing about being fractional is the flexibility. So if I need to work late one night because I choose to, I can. So that allows me that flexibility to make sure that I'm where I need to be. The other part, though, you said really important was being overwhelmed. And I have had to learn that, yes, sometimes I do get overwhelmed or just, oh my God, I don't have enough hours in the day. And that is usually my cue to turn off my laptop and go take a walk, or I have to get a break for my brain. If I don't, it leads to more of that overwhelm feeling. Like I mentioned about, you know, the shower, like I intentionally couldn't think of that. I didn't know who to go to. I was like searching. And literally it was when I turned off my brain and I was listening to music and taking a shower and it like came up. So I think that's very important for anyone who's juggling multiple clients is rest, breaks, you know, turning off your brain and using it for something else really allows you to get back in that groove. People think it's the reverse of like, oh my God, I'm avoiding. No, sometimes your brain just is too rabbit holey and you need to take that break so it starts over.
Yeah, and like, it's okay if you're avoiding. It's okay. Go and take a rest. Like, the world's not going to stop spinning. Right. I relate to this so hard where I think I can pinpoint every essay I've ever published to the seed of that essay happening on a hill. Mm-hmm. Where I'm just like out walking and I'm like, ah, I have to run back. Sometimes I will like, it sounds a bit mad, but I will like write it in my head while I'm walking. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is the thesis. And it's when these things just seem to happen when I don't have input, when there's no other input, like getting slammed by all these notifications on my phone. I try and always walk without a phone. I call it like my unreachable time. And sometimes when I start that unreachable time, I feel a little antsy and I'm like, but what if someone needs to reach me? And then I'm like, well, they'll reach me in an hour or they'll reach me this afternoon. And it will likely, so far, 100% of the time, it's been fine.
Well, it is, but it's so hard because we are the information download generation. Like everything is coming at us. So again, cell phones are a blessing. I love mine. Trust me, you know, you ever get into a flat tire incident or a car accident, like, right. It's great. I remember back when I got into my first car accident, there was no cell phone, right? Like I remember those days. That being said, I think we have all become so connected that we feel guilt if we disconnect. And unfortunately, that is not a feeling we should be having, but I think it's one that we all war with, where it's, no, not everything is urgent and important. Like, it can wait. To your point, like, it can wait an hour. A huge thing I do is, like, I don't answer my phone, and I'm sure that's crazy, but I wait for a message and I listen to the message, because half the time they tell me what they need on the message and they don't even want me to call them back. And I'm like, that could have been an email.
Yeah. I am curious from your perspective, because I imagine you have a really unique perspective where you have a vantage point of lots of other fractionals and probably lots of founders and businesses. And so I'd love to understand some of your kind of predictions, and where do you think the puck is going? If life was a hockey game, where is the puck going? What would you be betting on?
Oh, there's a couple of bets I have. So the first I'm betting on is, I do believe fractional, contract, freelance, I do believe all of this is going to be a lot more popular. There have been a lot of studies done globally, and they really do see that it's going to keep increasing. But as companies are really trying to run lean, they're going to need talent to come in for temporary periods and then leave. And I think that that is going to just become more common, especially as founders understand that fractional doesn't mean less loyal than a full-time employee. I also think founders are really trying to understand how to run lean, with especially with AI. And so there is this idea of, well, I need somebody, but I also need this skill set. And I'm not necessarily talking to AI, but like a very specific skill set that AI cannot help me with. But AI could do something that's really minute, like send out emails, you know, or things. Again, I'm really talking automation as well. We've had automation for decades, and it's really helpful, right? So as that's going to come in, they're going to need less full-time people, because they're going to need that strategic person to come in and do that thing that AI cannot do. And so I see that happening a lot. The other thing that I also am really starting to see is that everyone really likes AI from a founder and company standpoint, but they are spending a lot of money on tools that don't make sense for the stage they're in. Mm-hmm. So I actually think AI will start decreasing in a lot of use cases for these companies, as they realize that not everything needs to be AI or automated. And so there's going to be a lot more almost like split between what are they really good at and what are human beings good at. And you're going to see that difference there.
Ooh, that's spicy. I love it. Yeah, I mean, there's so much talk, right? Like, are we in an AI bubble? And I mean, there is so much money and capital being funded into these AI companies, which also means there is so much competition. And I don't know about you, but I found myself actually actively not using AI tools apart from literally Claude. Like, Anthropic is kind of my go-to. And I found myself pulling back and pulling back and pulling back from other ones. I think firstly, just from an overwhelm sense, every time you log on, there's a different one breaking, you need to try it. When I'm like, actually, I'm like really efficient with Claude Code as a like non-technical founder. And it's doing everything I need. And I think if I was to add more tools, in fact, it would just be a distraction from the work that I know I need to do.
It's interesting that you said that, for kind of two points. The first is, I was reading, I swear it had to be a LinkedIn post, and I wish I could remember who wrote it, but they were actually saying that it was interesting with AI because it's supposed to be this time savings. But instead of like, and so we'll just say like ChatGPT. So ChatGPT is doing something for them. But then over here, instead of them going to do something else, they're like watching it do it. So it's like, it's not even saving me time. They're like, I'm just like watching it, and instead of like getting that time back. So it was like a humorous insight. But I do think that that's part of, we still don't quite trust it. We're still watching it. We're still seeing it. So like, how much time savings is it really doing? But the other thing with that is, I think there's going to be more cannibalism in these AI companies, right? So one of the things I do is I volunteer for a dog rescue that's local here, right? Huge animal lover, love it. And we needed to train people on stuff. I hate making presentations. So again, this was like 3 years ago, I did a presentation and I used Gamma AI, right? And now if I showed you, because I still have it, the presentation I did 3 years ago and the presentation I've done now, I mean, it has been hugely updated. Mm-hmm. That is something, time savings, I love it. I'm never getting rid of my Gamma AI. That being said, you mentioned Claude. So Claude recently just added Gamma AI into their system. And so that's what I'm going to say. I believe you're right. There's going to be a couple of these big companies that are going to have some of the more common tools already in them, either as a partnership or whatnot. And it is to get people, I don't even want to say more comfortable because I don't think it is. I think it's just going to be, there's going to be these everyday tools. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to notice more, because I think in a lot of cases, AI is almost a distraction and it's like busy work instead of actually helping us accomplish something that we really need. I think that like scrolling on TikTok, like, you know, you love doing it, but it's you can't do it all day long.
Yeah. I'm kind of imagining it like it's this meta tool. And in fact, maybe there will be an enormous acquisition roll up of these like smaller tools to bring them all under the same umbrella, which I'm not convinced is a good thing. Like, I think the two front runners are obviously Anthropic and OpenAI. And there's been a huge pushback recently to OpenAI. And I'm a Claude girly, like through and through. And I've like done a lot of like research and looking into basically their ethics and safety perspectives. However, I'm putting a lot of trust that they're going to do what they say. And so far, so good. But I think that it's healthy to have lots of competition because it also keeps people honest, right? So let's say, I don't know, Claude sells to OpenAI, never going to happen, but let's say. And then we're like, oh, dang, that's kind of, we put all our eggs in that one basket. And now what?
I think of it very much like streaming services right now. You know, originally it was cable companies. We put all of our eggs in the baskets of like three or four major cable companies in the United States. And it was a disaster and prices were ridiculous. So then streaming services came out. And we're like, oh my God, we paid like a quarter of the price and we get all this content. And then it boomed and we had so many options and now they're consolidating again. I think we're going to see these ebbs and flows. I agree with you. I think competition is needed. It makes a lot of sense. But I think we're going to see a lot more competition in things that AI is expensive. Like, it is really expensive. And right now, the reason it's successful is that it's being subsidized by the governments. It's being subsidized, you know, I mean, even electricity is being subsidized in these data centers. That won't happen for the rest of our lives. And so eventually, at some point, those subsidies are going to start getting pulled back. And that's why I think these other companies are going to start having to get gobbled up, because it's very expensive to run this. And right now, we're not paying that price really on the consumer side. I mean, we are at the end of the day, but we're only paying, what, $20 a month? Like, oh, this is nothing. That won't be the case. We'll see it get much more expensive. It's going to price people out because they're going to start losing a lot from the government subsidies. I really believe that.
That's a really interesting point, because there's like, you know, there's many different types of poverty. So there's like fuel poverty. And then when I moved up here to this island in the Highlands, they started talking about like connectivity poverty. And I was like, never heard that. But when you think about it, it is a sense of poverty. You don't have the same level of access. I mean, thankfully, we're able to have this call and the internet actually works okay from where I am. But let's say it didn't. That actually then would stop me from being able to do this podcast. And I wonder if there is going to be, as you say, when these subsidies stop, if there's going to be some level of AI poverty.
I do believe that. And that's why I think, again, I don't see it's going to be a bubble, but I think it'll be much more expensive. I think a lot of people won't be able to afford it on a daily basis. I think this is one of the biggest reasons why AI really started with those free plans as well, because they want to mine so much data, because at least they can make up that money on the back end. Mm. So, I mean, there's a way that they could potentially do it. But again, you would have to be comfortable giving away all that power. You know, the paid programs, you can at least block some of the learning. You can't do it on the free plans.
Oh, I could jam with you all day, Natalie. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you're disappointed, that you really wish I had asked?
I don't think that there's anything I'm disappointed you haven't asked. I think, again, to your point, there's just so many things we can talk about. It's like we could talk all day long, but, you know, I would probably put this back on you. Is there anything that you think in the Generalist World community that, man, they really, like, this is a question we get asked all the time that we should talk about?
I think what I'm seeing at the moment, which is different from the first, say, year we were running it to now we're kind of 3 years in, is one of the questions that we're actually getting asked a lot is, like, how can I create my own program? How I have this idea for this thing. How can Generalist World help me do it? And there's this, like, visceral sense of agency that I'm seeing amongst people. I saw Alana did this amazing post saying, like, I think she joined last October, and she was saying even in those, what, 6 months, how much her confidence has grown in, like, hosting meetups in Singapore and building stuff on Lovable. And there's something like contagious. And I mean, just this morning, I've had in my inbox from members, people wanting to host meetups around the world. Someone wants to run a hackathon for Generalist World. Someone's built this, like, AI skills playbook. And so I think one of the things that I'm seeing and one of the questions that I'm wrestling with is the community is kind of becoming this melting pot of ideas and innovation. And one of the things that I'm sitting with is how can we as a very small team enable people to, like, follow that agency and to use Generalist World as, like, a experimentation ground. That's kind of what it's feeling like.
I 100% agree. I think this is going to, again, keep happening more and more as people are looking for adventure, growth. Mm. I can, for me, the communities really give me a sense of community. Like, you get to interact with people, you get to help people. It fulfills a human need. And to your point, even the meetups, you know, we just had a meetup in Old Girls Club for Columbus, Ohio. We usually don't have meetups because we're very small, right? And it was great because it was, you know, like three of us, but it was that human connection that was even out, you know, outside of work. So I think those are going to be really more popular. What I imagine is going to be more of having opportunities for people in GW to start hosting a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. So again, you have three people, they can't do everything, but, you know, again, we'll look at me, right? So fractional, right? I know fractionals, I know whatever. There are easy ways for me to be able to give back without it being, oh, well, she's just doing it because she does coaching. Like, there are ways to, hey, you're starting to think about this, start thinking about it this way, like, preference this, same thing, you know, people who are building products. A great example happened today. Someone on GW posted that they're looking to build a product and they were looking for a platform. And so somebody was like, Kajabi. And I replied and I'm like, Kajabi is great, but it's really expensive. You need to know what you're trying to build and what pieces you need so you understand what software. So like, I think turning some of these conversations into, hey, you know, this is a topic. Is anyone in GW willing to run with it and host a meetup and we can talk about it? So it's not always on you three. Mm-hmm. It's on the community to start helping each other build additional things.
Totally. And that is absolutely the shift that we've been seeing in the last year where, I mean, Edja is the queen of this, truly, where people are constantly now coming to her with ideas. And I've seen a shift in her as well, where it's gone from like, okay, well, how can we do this to a bit like, go for it. Like, you're in the community, we trust you. These are the guidelines, you know, having very clear guidelines of what we will and won't, you know, tolerate. But like 99.99% of the time, people are super respectful and they get it. You know the feeling and the culture inside GW. So I think that's kind of what I'm honestly really excited to see, because when I started this all those years ago, it really felt like I had to kind of be at the center, and it was like, I have to like show up every day and be the one pushing it, when now I'm not. Like, I am so far, I'm like, I don't even know if I'm in a ring. Sometimes I'm like, I don't even know what everyone's up to. There's so many interesting things happening, and that is perfection. It has become a world, which is exactly what it, I think, was meant to be.
Yeah, and again, it's that community piece. It's, you know, people want to give back. They want to engage. They want to be impactful to others. They just don't always know how to. So being in a community, I think it's really an easier way to start, because somebody starts a conversation. Somebody shows that they need help. And so if you can help them, your instinct is to be like, oh yeah, like, let me give you some advice here. Oh, absolutely. Yes, this will help lift you up. And it'll keep growing and developing, especially as people get much more comfortable with their confidence to be able to speak up and say, yeah, I know how to do this and I can help you. I am the expert here. And I think that's something that it takes people time to be empowered by. But I really do hope and expect that we're going to see a lot more people in the next couple of years really becoming more empowered. Oh,
I think that is the high that the world needs to end on. Natalie, this has been fantastic. We are going to link all of your links in the show notes so people can reach out and say hello. And thank you so much for coming on the GW podcast.
Thank you again so much for having me. And again, if you guys aren't members of GW, highly recommend it. It's an awesome community.
Thank you.